This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is it science or fiction? Both.
This week on Radio EcoShock, top climate science fiction writers Kim Stanley Robinson and Bruce Sterling.
No writer has written more popular novels about climate change than Kim Stanley Robinson. With tons of awards and readers, if you don't know K.S. Robinson, you should. In the 1990s, I devoured his Mars trilogy. Robinson's 2020 book, The Ministry for the Future, drew raves from Barack Obama, Bill Gates, James Cameron, Bill McKibben, almost everyone. The horrific opening, with millions dying in extreme heat, turns into a vision of how we might survive ourselves. From California, Kim Stanley Robinson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's good to be with you.
Well, let's start where you began in ministry. In the future, 20 million people die in extreme heat beyond human tolerance. 60 to 70,000 Europeans died in the heat wave of 2003. Where I live in British Columbia, hundreds died in the burning heat of 2021. How did you see this coming?
I read about it in the scientific literature about 2017, and doing a little bit of history investigation, it seems to me that the finding was first published by a doctor, an epidemiologist, in 2010, pointing out that human bodies can't survive a wet bulb 35 temperature, which is a combination of heat and humidity. High heat, high humidity in combination will kill people within several hours from hyperthermia. And I think this was really somewhat known before, but the pieces of the puzzle hadn't been put together to point out that we simply can't adapt to extremely high temperatures that we're creating by, you know, releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that the so-called adaptationists of the previous decades were factually wrong. And when I discovered that, I thought, I have to write this up, even though it's going to be an ugly scene to write. It's important to tell people that this is possible, that without electricity, people will be fatally endangered by high heat and humidity that we're already seeing from moment to moment across the Earth.
Strangely, though, heat deaths often go down after a mass casualty event as people adapt. The government of India developed a heat strategy. Some folks in Vancouver bought air conditioning for the first time. But if the grid goes down, as you say, the next great heat death might not be in India. It might be in Houston or Phoenix. What do you think?
Yes, it's true. One of the hottest wet bulb temperatures ever recorded was right outside of Chicago. So the American Midwest, the American Southeast, and anywhere on the planet where it isn't dry heat but humid heat, and that, of course, is an ecological and geographical matter and extends quite far north and south of the equator, although, of course, the further north in the northern hemisphere, the further south in the southern hemisphere, the less likely it becomes. But there's a really broad zone of the habitable Earth where these temperatures are possible. And then it's a question of grid strength and social organization, preparation, knowledge of what needs to be done in an emergency like that. And then saving of lives can be differential, but if we lose electricity, then the situation immediately becomes intensely dangerous, and there's nothing to be done about that.
I blame both media and the government for underplaying the grave risk of deadly heat in a warming world. Few know that more people die of heat-related causes than in all the floods and hurricanes combined. Is heat the silent killer? It doesn't make good TV, but it is dangerous.
Yes, it tends also to first afflict the unwell, the elderly, the very young. It isn't universal when it strikes, and so far, truthfully, it has only struck for a few hours or at most a few days at a time in situations where the grid held, people had air conditioning, and indeed lots of people died. You mentioned Europe, and quite a few years earlier, 70,000 people died in the heat wave. It's happened twice, but 70,000 in a population of 300 million tends to get overlooked, even though that is 70,000 human lives that wouldn't have died without the heat event and improper preparation for it. So, yes, it does get overlooked. It's the silent killer in this situation. But since the main effect of our CO2 pollution of the atmosphere is rising heat, it really ought to be taken into account as a major factor.
And for those with scientific awareness of what climate change could really mean, there are only desperate optimists and doomers, I think, and I vacillate between the two. The dark pessimists loved the beginning of the Ministry of the Future, but were disappointed you looked for ways out. Did that surprise you?
I wonder if people were truly disappointed. Doomers are sort of like cynics. They are idealists whose dreams have been shattered and they overreact. There's a Latin American phrase, it's too late to be pessimistic. There's a certain moral necessity of holding to what Gramsci called pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. And it's very important to remember you will that optimism. It might not be a natural result of looking at the situation, which is indeed quite dire, but you will it as a moral stance and as a commitment to the people of the future, that even though we have accidentally and irresponsibly and in some places criminally created a super dangerous situation, going forward, there won't be doom. That is a comfort. That is a solace to think, well, it'll all be over. Apocalyptic thinking is a kind of comfort food. What you really ought to say is it's going to be better or it's going to be worse. And work can be done to make it better, and worse could be quite bad. It doesn't mean extinction for the human race. It means extinction for thousands of other species, and some humans will squeak by. It could be extremely bad. I don't want to underestimate or underplay the level of badness for humanity. If billions die, that's bad enough. You don't have to say everybody will die, because that's not realistic to human ingenuity and capacity for survival. But survival isn't really what we're talking about here, unless you want to say survival of civilization. That could be lost, and that's bad enough.
The novel leads to big changes in human society, including a sort of new internet, new currency, and cooperatives, but does not explain exactly how this will all come about. And I think that is asking way too much of anyone, even you. But all that said, how do you see some of those solutions now, 4 years later?
Well, I'm seeing the rapid emergence of all of them. So I want to share a message of optimism despite the ongoing potential catastrophe. It's a kind of a strange situation to describe because on the one hand, if we push through some planetary boundaries, as Johan Rockström calls them, and crash tipping points so that we tip over into a hothouse Earth, then after that, there's very little we can do to stop those processes from proceeding. On the other hand, the rapid deployment of better methods of financing, of clean energy transition, and of social awareness. I think actually the pandemic provided a service for humanity in there, like a punch on the nose, and indeed the death of perhaps 16 million humans. But what it taught us was the biosphere can rise up and change everything quickly and kill people and disrupt lives in fundamental ways. And since the pandemic, awareness that climate change could do the same and even more irrevocably is wider spread than ever, so that the various solutions that I sketched out in Ministry for the Future, which is all reporting, they're not my invention. I took them out of the various literatures involved. All those methodologies have been proceeding apace, and the important ones, and so I'm not talking about the ownership of the internet so much as I'm talking about financing the clean transition, these are really seeing rapid development across the board. And I would say that in the 4 years since I wrote my book and the 3 years since it came out and traveling around the world, that awareness of the problem at the level of government, diplomats, business people, academics, and what you might call the general public is much heightened, and we're in more of an emergency mode than we were before the pandemic. And so I wrote the book before the pandemic. It's possible that my book is more pessimistic than it needs to be given where we are now.
Wow. Well, following the publication, you did tour internationally, as you say, not so much to promote the book, but to discuss it. Have you felt like an ambassador for a novel or for a future?
Well, for a future, I would say that I have inadvertently blown up my career as a novelist and had to regather it as some kind of public intellectual. And actually, the figure of a public intellectual is kind of a 20th century thing that's gone away. I'm uncomfortable with my new role, but I'm figuring that it's important work, that I've actually came to a hiatus in my novel writing anyway, to tell you the truth. I did not have to put off a project that was burning me through my brain to get onto the page. On the contrary, Ministry for the Future was kind of the end of a phase and time to rethink. So in that time, I've been doing climate change awareness, but also the various medications that are still possible and spreading the word as best I can.
Pinnacle capitalists like Bill Gates blogged about your book. The Financial Times reported meetings that you might have had with bankers and investors or even the military. Yet many of your books search for alternatives to capitalism. Kim, does capitalism have to go, and is there any alternative?
It's a great question, Alex, and I cope with it all the time. I would say capitalism is one name for the problem itself. It's a power relation in which the few take advantage of the many and also appropriate and devastate the biosphere of the earth for what turns out to be personal profit. It's a bad system. I'm anti-capitalist. It's the system that we're in now. So we have the nation-state system, global capitalism. Neither one is well-suited for the climate emergency, but it's what we've got, and we are short of time. I don't think it's possible to rapidly change the political economy of the world, not quickly enough to cope with this overriding problem. So that sounds bad, and it is bad. What does one do then? I think you need to look to capitalist methods that in the past have been brought to bear to cope with emergencies, such as the Depression of the 1930s and World War II itself. It was a capitalist powers that won World War II by way of the government taking over business and saying, you work for this project now. We're going to pay you for it. You're still going to make a limited profit. People are going to make a living, have jobs, but it's going to be under the direction of government. So sometimes this is called Keynesian capitalism. In any case, whatever the names are, we need to get past the neoliberal market rules all moment of 1980 to 2020 and quickly institute what might be called a kind of a throwback to Keynesian capitalism, and then push forward to some kind of post-capitalism where justice for people and sustainability and living with the biosphere, justice for the biosphere in effect, that these are encoded into the laws and into our economic practices and how we pay ourselves. Now, what that gets called is, you know, open to interpretation. I think 19th century labels are perhaps not adequate, or they misrepresent the situation, which is going to be evolving as we speak. And so, to be specific about it, the central banks of the world, those are capitalist powers, but they're run by government. So immediately government becomes an actor in this political economy that we live in. And you might say that government and finance are hand in hand, but they're arm wrestling for control. This I find a good image. And in this case, given the emergency, government has to win that arm wrestling match with finance. It's not all about maximizing profit. It's about getting into balance with the biosphere and creating justice among people. And in that collaborative contest between government and business, government and finance, government, which is to say of the people, by the people, for the people, government needs to prevail right now. So this is a political battle that I think is maybe winnable. I certainly see many humans in positions of power and responsibility who want to win it in that form of getting more control over what we do in order to save ourselves. So this is how I'm trying to frame it.
Terraforming, it's an intentional shaping of a planet to support human life. In the popular Mars trilogy, you examine those issues at a safe distance in space. Will geoengineering be attempted in a climate emergency, and what do you think about that?
Let me go back to the idea that we're in a carbon dioxide overshoot. There's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We put it there. That's already geoengineering, but it was done by accident, and it's a kind of a mistake. will be heating up the planet in ways that in geological time are almost instantaneous. And it's an uncontrolled experiment. We have no idea what will happen to the Earth systems, but it's very possible that we will kick off a hothouse Earth, which is to say no ice on this planet. And no ice on this planet means sea level is 270 feet higher than it is now. Well, that is the danger. And going forward, we have to cope with that danger. If you label that geoengineering and say, oh, we shouldn't do anything so hubristic as mess with the Earth system, A, we've already messed with the Earth system. B, we may be cooking ourselves by that accidental geoengineering. And then C, we should probably try some positively inclined geoengineering to lower the temperatures. The main thing to do is to drag CO2 out of the atmosphere. That will take decades, and that should not be labeled geoengineering. That's simply doing the necessary. But in the meantime, while we're overcooked, while there is too much CO2 in the atmosphere, there are some cooling methods that are being proposed that during the decades of overshoot, we might want to do some other things to cool the planet while we get the CO2 out of the atmosphere. Those, I think, you can gather under this name geoengineering, but the methodologies being suggested are radically different from each other in terms of how planetary they are, how, in other words, are they local or are they global? Are they modular or are they systemic? Can they be reversed or are they irreversible? And each one of the methods being proposed has a different answer to those important questions. They all should be studied. And a lot of them might be employed if we could solve the governance problem of deciding how to do it and then doing it.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is famous science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson. My guest Jean-Marc Jancovici pointed out humans know very well how to live without fossil fuels. We lived without them almost all of our time on this planet. But, Kim, can we go back before technology?
No, there is no before technology. That's a bad framing. Humans evolved with their technologies. Technology came into play with pre-humans by way of fire and stone tools. And then we co-evolved with these technologies and became human beings. So it's never right to say before technology. There's good tech, there's clean tech, there's bad tech, there's dirty tech, there's unnecessary technologies. There are also technologies that are software systems. So law is a technology, and even language, another pre-human tech that grew and grew up. Yes, we got by without fossil fuels for the entirety of human existence until 150 years ago, say. And then we became very reliant on them. And the human population, it wasn't just fossil fuels, it was also public health and medicine, blossomed. And typically, the human population was less than a billion people. Now it's 8 billion. We need energy to make sure all humans alive have a decent existence. That can be provided by clean post-fossil fuel energy systems that use sunlight, wind power, wave power, tide power, and geothermal. In other words, we can transition to new technologies that are way cleaner and better for the biosphere than burning up the fossil carbon that was stuck underground. That being done, we can supply adequacy for the 8 billion, and it's not the total solution because there's never a total solution to our problems. But it does get to the heart of one of the worst things that we're doing, which is pumping a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere as a waste of burning fossil fuels. So we got to get off fossil fuels. We still need terawatts of energy to have decency for 8 billion people, which is kind of an astonishingly high number of humans on the planet. And yet we can provide that clean energy to that many people. And it looks like the human population itself is somewhat stabilizing and might even go down a little in the century to come, which would take a huge stress off of the system, but it isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is the clean transition.
No doubt your 22 novels have been sucked into the whirlpool that feeds artificial intelligence. Do you think AI will save this civilization or kill it?
Well, neither. We're in what Cory Doctorow calls an AI bubble. a moment of hype and intense speculation. We're in a science fiction story that we're creating, and we don't know the ending. What is AI? Well, even that's hard to answer, because the name itself is hype. It's artificial for sure, but is it intelligence, or is it extremely rapid computation? If all along it had been called extremely rapid computation, or if it had been called exceptionally powerful adding machines, nobody would be as freaked out as they are. So the name AI itself is deceptive. We write the algorithms. We have very fast computers. They can perform operations that an individual human cannot, but it was humans as a collective that invented these machines. And they can't take over. This is one of those bad science fiction stories that overlooks the questions of agency. We employ them as a tool like any other tool. And it's getting to be a powerful tool in terms of organizing information, and organizing information is really important. It is indeed one of the technological achievements of the time, and somewhat out of control. I would hope that people will put AI in perspective as sort of a science fiction story walking amongst us, and that we're telling each other collectively, and some people are using it like Frankenstein story or a horror movie or a zombie movie. The various kinds of stories that we've already told in the past, when you attempt to put it on this extremely rapid computation, usually distorts the reality of the situation and even the reality of the possibilities to come. So the one I would end this by saying, it's a powerful enough tool that you want governance for your tool. You want some rules. You want some regulations. You don't buy a chainsaw feeling worried that it might explode in your hand or leap at your throat and cut your head off. You want to have regulations that mean that that tool is safe when you use it. And AI is deserving of that kind of regulation and that kind of regard. So I don't want to dismiss it, but I don't want it to be seen as some kind of conscious agent that is aching to take over world history. That's just not true.
Some of your books are so well-researched, they're called hard science fiction. Was there some early experience that led you to write about climate?
Maybe so. As an aside, I'll say that I like being a science fiction writer, but I don't like any of the adjectives applied to it. Hard science fiction in the past was usually mostly hard in its political attitudes towards the poor. The actual science in it was just as shaky as any soft science fiction. I mean, faster than light travel being a staple of hard science fiction, that whole supposed genre is delegitimated right from the start. They're all game spaces. They're all fictional, made-up spaces. The future is unknown. So I went to Antarctica courtesy of the U.S. National Science Foundation in 1995. It was 2 months of dreamy, great, beautiful experience, both of humans and of that icy landscape down there. Two of the best months of my life. And all the scientists down there, and that's the bulk of the population down there, along with the people helping them stay alive, the scientists were all talking about climate change and what that was going to do to not Antarctica, which is a relatively, not inert, but a slow-moving giant chunk of ice, but to the rest of the world. So they were already talking climate change as being an overriding consideration, even in their own research programs. Like, what'll it do to Antarctica? But wow, what'll it do to the rest of the world? And that was 1995. And ever since then, I've been highly attuned to this. The way that our human lives and human history as a collective has been overwhelmed by what we've done to the climate. That now our coping with the problem we've created with climate change is the major driver of world history. We have to cope with that successfully, and every other human story rests under that dark cloud.
As for Ministry of the Future, one critic did not like the included love story, but what kind of future would not have love in it? And tell us about your latest love story in the Book of the Mountains.
Yes, I'm a novelist, and I needed the personal. We read novels for characters and for plot, and plot is usually the story of characters coping with something that's gone wrong. So you need that. And I had that in Mystery for the Future. There's a kind of backbone to this amorphous, weird body of the novel. It's definitely got everything plus the kitchen sink thrown into it. But Mary and Frank's story, which is a very peculiar love story, to tell you the truth, the kind of older sister, younger brother, and the younger brother's always screwing up, it's that kind of a love story, not your typical romance. That was important to me, and I think it's important to readers. I don't think Ministry for the Future would have had the same impact that it did without the characters in their plot holding it all together as something that you have a personal interest in as well as a general communal interest in. And then in terms of my subsequent work, in the pandemic and with ministry done and out in the world and kind of blowing my life apart, the pandemic allowed me to write about the Sierra Nevada of California. That definitely was a love story. It's a miscellany like ministry, but it's all about the history, geology, personalities, and a really even a memoir, which I'd never attempted before, about my backpacking life in the Sierra Nevada. Well, this is just a hobby, I have to say. I'm not really a mountain person. I'm a suburban house husband who has a hobby of going to the Sierra Nevada as much as I can. It's been great. I've loved it, but I'm not claiming that it's world-shattering or important. But it is a love story in that when I'm up there, I feel that I'm in love with a landscape. That's strange enough to be worth unpacking and thinking about and then writing about. It was a huge pleasure to do it, and I'm really glad I got that opportunity.
And I see your novel Red Mars is slated for a TV series. There has to be a film in The Ministry of the Future. Is a movie in the works, or do we have to wait, unfortunately, for real life to see that?
Well, that is one of those unanswerable questions because of Hollywood being Hollywood. Ministry is optioned by an excellent studio. They have an excellent director, excellent writer. That still doesn't mean there's going to be a TV series. It hasn't been green-lighted. There's steps to take. Until one sees it on one's screens, you can't be sure that it will get done. But progress is being made, and it's by people who I think are really good at what they do. So, I have my fingers crossed, but it's not in my power to make it happen.
Well, as we wrap up, on behalf of my listeners, I have to ask, world oceans are way hotter than ever, Greenland shedding 30 tons of ice an hour, coral in the Amazon seem doomed, the northern forests were afire last summer. Kim, do you still think humanity makes it out of this, or civilization makes it out of this alive?
Humanity makes it out alive, but that could be some kind of remnant that would be traumatized and sad, but let's not talk about human extinction. That's not really the danger. The danger is civilization. And it's so dangerous that I wouldn't want to make any assurances. We are still acting carelessly, like it isn't existential when it is. Still burning fossil fuels at a rapid clip of billions of tons per year, about 30 or 40 billion tons per year. It's too much. It needs to come down as fast as we can make it happen, and we're not doing that. So to minimize the danger would be wrong. On the other hand, as I said, in the last 3 years, I've seen that this truth, this reality, has penetrated at all levels of human society in ways that are going to matter. So maybe we're seeing a tipping point towards humanity realizing that this is an existential crisis, and maybe it will bring all humans on board to be regarding their efforts as part of the larger effort in some giant team sense. When you say things like that, people can easily look around at the world today and say, you've got to be kidding. But emergencies call forth emergency behaviors on the part of people. We see that all the time. And so if there's a recognition of a global emergency, there might be a global response. I see signs of it. So we're in a race. We're in a race between catastrophe and prosperity, and it's a quite serious race. So you can't say that what the ending's going to be at this point. It's like a dead heat. In terms of the race, and you can't give up at this point because that would be bad for the good side winning the race. And that's the only thing I can say about it right now. We're in a race, and it's a tie, and we need to work harder than ever every day to try to have the good side win.
From California, we've been speaking with American author and sci-fi icon Kim Stanley Robinson. I will post a list of his climate-oriented books and the Kim Stanley Robinson Facebook page run by his publishers in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kim, thank you for sharing your mind with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now, the time has passed and we can sort of sit on our hands because we're not really going to get that opportunity. We're basically looking at two possibilities. We got a world that's unimaginable, and we got a world that's unthinkable.
Another top climate-aware sci-fi writer is American author Bruce Sterling. He was among the originators of cyberpunk science fiction. Sterling was early on in climate awareness with his 1995 novel, Heavy Weather, which gets more true by the day. This feature, produced by Radio EcoShock in 2006, hardly any of you have ever heard it, contains clips with Bruce Sterling at SWSX 2005 in Austin, Texas, and an interview on the now-defunct BigPicture.tv. He warned us.
Fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it, pretty much all the time.
We're going to take a whirlwind tour of a whirlwind, one Michael Bruce Sterling. He's a science fiction writer, working visionary and cyber green activist. Along the way, we'll encounter the planet of the dumps, green design, spimes, total tracking of everything, oh yeah, and the mega threat of climate change. This is Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock. Along with the usual collection of audio clips, you'll have to put up with my reading a few Sterling quotes. He's a writer, after all. His science fiction career started at the University of Texas. In the 1980s, Sterling was a founder of the cyberpunk genre. He's sold millions of books since his first novel, Shizmatrix. The 1986 anthology of cyberpunk, edited by Sterling, titled Mirror Shades, is still a classic. He also co-wrote with William Gibson the 1990 steampunk novel, The Difference Engine. His first nonfiction novel was The Hacker Crackdown, which followed the U.S. Secret Service raids on a Texas game maker. Since then, Sterling has become a widely published journalist, including his column in Wired magazine. He's a popular speaker at conventions. As the future unravels before us, Sterling interprets new technology and culture warping. He founded an online community called Viridian, which promotes neo-green design and high-tech solutions. We'll also hear about his later publication, Shaping Things, published by MIT Press. And none of this captures the real Bruce Sterling. He's a very unassuming man in person. His life is a travel schedule, a laptop exploration of cyberspace, some mind-blowing, and some beer. His rich inner mind really pours out in his books and speeches. He offers things and dictates nothing.
You know, I'm one guy. This is my hobby. I don't have a secretary. I've never looked for foundation support. I mean, basically, I'm a tech commentator and sometime theorist.
Back in the early 1990s, Bruce Sterling became personally concerned about climate change and published a novel about it in 1995 called Heavy Weather. Set in his home state of Texas, the survivors of heat, drought, and drug-resistant diseases set out checking all the violent storms that depopulated the region by 2031. The future comes early, doesn't it? As we all know, heavy weather is already appearing. More and more, Sterling is a magnet and stimulant for green solutions blogging like worldchanging.com and Treehugger. There is an urgency to his green cyber activism. For example, back in 1999, Sterling told the Industrial Designers Society of America National Conference, "Nature is over. The 20th century did it in. There's not a liter of seawater anywhere without its share of PCB and DDT. An altered climate will reshuffle the ecological deck for every creature that breathes. You can't escape industrialism and hide from the sky. It's over. From now on, nature is under surveillance and on life support. Face up to it. A 21st century avant-garde has to deal with those consequences and thrive in that world." End quote. These threats are multidimensional.
You know, I've written science fiction novels on topics like this in the past, but just listen to this. This is what our civilization is confronting now. We've got like 14 chronic problems. Habitat destruction and deforestation. soil erosion and soil loss, water shortages, overhunting, overfishing, alien species breaking in on older ecosystems, human population growth, the per capita impact of people's consumption going up, climate change, bioaccumulative chemicals in the ecosystem, energy shortages, and number 14, kind of my favorite, humanity is approaching the point of using up the Earth's entire photosynthetic capacity. And they're all sort of classic future issues because they're all on a slow timeline. They're not the sort of thing that can be solved by, you know, two years in the House of Representatives. They're just at a slower pace than the ethical, legal, social, and political institutions that we've built to date. So I think of it as an infrastructural problem, it's a design problem, it's an engineering problem. And I actually expect to see most of these problems diminishing during my lifetime, and I think they will be defeated sometime in the 2060s. Now, and I'm not an optimist or a pessimist about this subject. I actually think these are just chronic issues which are bubbling up so hard that it's going to be impossible to deny them. And I think the most interesting people in our society are going to be the people who are willing and able to tackle these.
Billions of humans all over the world are leaving the countryside to live in cities. It is one of the most startling developments of the new century.
Right. Well, we're heading for 11 billion people, and they're going to be in cities. Because there really isn't any other way to put 11 people. We got, you know, what is it? We're pushing 7 now.
Pushing 7. The hope is that we're going to level off at 9 if we do it right.
You know, we might hit 9, we might hit 11. You know, it depends on a lot of factors. But basically, that's 50% more people living in areas that sort of don't exist yet. Because, you know, a lot of us are still going to be here. So that stuff has all got to be designed, and it's all got to be built. And it can't be built in the old way. It's just not going to work. So we're going to have to come up with just radical new means of housing, radical new means of transportation.
One of the things that's, for a while, I've been going around quoting the statistic that I heard, that we're building a city the size of Seattle every 4 days. And a couple months ago, a guy came up to me who's a demographer, and he said, no, that's totally wrong. It's about every 7.5 days. So, you know, yeah. You know, I mean, that's between population growth and people moving from the country to the city. We're basically cranking out a major, you know, urban center every, you know, about 7.5 days. And we need to figure out ways of providing the kinds of services and the kinds of, you know, structures that people need to live in gigantic cities. I mean, Mexico City, what's Mexico City now?
That's Alex Steffens of worldchanging.com at SWX 2005. Rural living was self-contained, but city dwellers must haul in vast quantities of food and resources while trucking out equally vast piles of waste.
Because all these objects that we unilaterally abandoned are sitting in big dumps just over the water table. They're rotting, they're emitting methane, you know, and there can only be more. There can only be more dump. Because everything that ends in a dump, you know, eventually the percentage of the planet that's dump has to grow larger and larger over a period of time unless you can figure out how to fold the dump back into the production stream.
Right.
And I suspect we will be mining dumps in pretty short order. You know, because there's a lot of very useful material in dumps. And if you go and look at, like, the amount of junk that has to be mined in an iron mine, or the amount of just havoc that's wreaked to, like, dig gold, just a few traces of gold out of huge amounts of rock, you can recycle anything if you're willing to put enough energy and attention into it. And I suspect we're going to find by the middle of the 21st century that people actually go out and, like, stake claims on dumps.
The real solution to waste, Sterling suggests, is to design it out of the system in the first place. We can use biologically degradable materials to replace toxic synthetic ones. We can reduce the mass of everything we use, light vehicles, lighter buildings. And we can make sure everything is reused or recycled in some way. All this starts in the original designs pouring out of computers around the world. Here is Sterling speaking at the SWX Conference 2005.
I mean, there's three things you can do, basically, if you want to have a sustainable economy, a sustainable physical event, and I think we're going to do all three in different ways. First, there's neobiology and biomimetics. You just make the stuff out of natural material, so if you lose it, it rots. And it just goes away, and it's okay, so what? A tree ate it. We mulched the rose bushes with it. That's fine. Then the second method is you can build monuments. In other words, I'll just, like, build this thing that I know is going to last 800 years. This is kind of the John Ruskin approach. And I was like, I will make everything out of great big timber and great heavy stones, and we'll build for the ages, and we'll abandon fashion, and you know, it'll be artsy and craftsy and rough hewn and honest and gothic. Except the difficulty with that approach is you don't get to change your mind about it. It's like grandpa makes all the decisions and then you just have to live that way. So those two ways are doable. I mean, there's a certain amount of that being done already. You know, you can install infrastructure that lasts a long time and so forth. And if you build it right, it'll last and it won't be a big load on the environment. And then the third way is a way that was never thought of before, that I've been writing about a lot. I just wrote a book about this for MIT Press, and that's to label everything in the environment and digitally track it. Just give everything a unique identity and just kind of Google the barcode, scan it, watch it throughout its lifetime. You start from before it exists with a digital plan for the object. You follow it through the production stream. You follow it through the distribution stream. You follow it from the retailer to the person who owns it. You follow it from the owner to the person he sells it to. And then when it finally breaks, you just sort of push a button and say, "Be gone from my presence." And it automatically calls in somebody who takes it and pulls it apart, designed for disassembly. So this is like, that would be like a fully cyberneticized environment. An internet of things. We have an internet now. We have an internet of web pages, but we don't have an internet of things. The closest you can see to it is something like Amazon, where you see like a very large number of items, and they're all surrounded by like a haze of data. Go and like look at book on Amazon. You're not actually getting the book. If you buy a book at Amazon, you're actually getting a digital representation of a book. In fact, you can buy a book on Amazon before it exists. And I suspect this is like the future for a lot of manufactured objects. In other words, they're sort of made in a very short run. They're not stockpiled. They don't even come to exist before I pay for it. Like the Dell computer method. You know, you can like specify everything you want from a Dell computer. It's because the thing doesn't exist until you pay for it. Once you pay for it and tell them what to do it, they make it on the spot and then ship it to you. You know, and then if they could just watch the thing throughout its entire lifespan and then pull the components apart and take them back when you were done, it'd be kind of game over at that point. You wouldn't have lost anything. You would have simply sipped it the way Alex is sipping his Coke and then returned the aluminum shell to the recycler, and it would all be just in a nice closed loop, right? All it would require is like incredible bandwidth, fantastic tracking capabilities, and unbelievable databases. And basically a complete remake of the political, economic, legal, and social system. And those happen all the damn time. You know, it's not as big a step as it was from the 17th century to the 18th century, or the 18th to the 19th. In fact, there are harbingers of it all around. Cradle to grave, auto-tracking objects, the Internet of Things. Like every object you buy has got a web page. Every object you buy has got some kind of Googleable identity. And I think we're going to see this. We're going to see it in outfits like Walmart and the Pentagon. Then we're going to see it trickling into like small office, home office applications. And eventually it's just going to be something you do. I would predict that most of the people in this room, when they're old, are going to be surrounded. You're going to be surrounded by trackable objects. And when you're looking for something you misplaced, you're going to Google it. You're not going to waste 18 hours looking for your damn car keys. "Honey, where are my shoes? What did you leave them last time? I'm 75. I don't even remember what kind of shoes I had." You're just going to say, "Where are your shoes?" And the system is going to say, "One is under the couch and the other one is in the freezer where you left it while you were getting the Häagen-Dazs." You know, and it will seem simpler. It'll seem simpler to a human being in the way that, like, Google is simpler.
So Stirling's original idea, adding to a mix of solutions, is the possibility of identifying and tracking all products so their final destination is not the dump, but reuse, stripping for new production, or composting for biomass. This is Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. In the next section, we'll dive into climate change and some solutions with Bruce Sterling, Green Visionary.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
This is part two of a feature on author and cybergreen activist Bruce Sterling. Sterling says we consumers have been purposely left in the dark about our products, other than the dreamlike data of advertising and labels. Knowledge about our possessions is proprietary to the manufacturer, we are told. So we don't know what is in them, or how toxic they might be. The spime is the opposite of that. And that is part of the new solution that Bruce Sterling offers for the problem of toxicity and waste in our society. You will know what's in it and where it came from. The end use or biologically safe disposal will be designed right into this object before it is ever made.
A spime is a contraction of the words space and time.
As we've heard, total tracking of all products would require a minor social revolution. Many libertarians are horrified at the ugly possibilities when everyone knows where everything goes and who uses what.
We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied.
But aren't we already well on our way? Walmart, the world's largest retailer, demands RFID radio tracking chips in every product they sell. Supermarkets use price incentives and shopping carts to track all our purchases. Basically, almost all products are already followed by computers. The only thing we don't track, says Sterling, is the disposal. You or your city can just keep burying the remnants of these toxic toys somewhere out there in the countryside or in your own body.
We're actually made out of gaseous technological junk.
As a cyberpunk writer, Sterling is all too aware of the potential for abuse in all this tracking. He foresees wrangling with, quote, spime spam, pushiness, abusive customers, intrusion, spying and eavesdropping capabilities, brooms that bellow ads, mops that demand money, subtle software faults that make even a simple shovel unusable, security flaws, hacking, theft, fraud, malware, vandalism, and pranking, industrial hazards, spime kitchens that fry the unwary, spime cars that follow outdated software maps and drive right off broken bridges, technological lock-in, wicked monopolists, corrupt regimes in on the take, and just plain ugliness. Tacky, goofy, tasteless, cheesy, lethal, vulgar, dirty, worthless, obscene, impractical, and dangerous spimes. End quote. But what is the alternative? Can we continue to pretend that Earth is a vast wasteland where we dump all the waste of 10 billion consumers? And we're not talking about those unseen places where we truck endless streams of toxic junk. We're talking about our own blood and lungs where daily pollution settles into disease.
You know, and you wonder, like, okay, how does woman's breast get jet fuel in it? Well, you know, any human body actually bioaccumulates jet fuel. It's going to, like, grab this jet fuel additive by preference, so that even if there's just a little bit of it, I mean, your teeth are made out of calcium, right? But you don't usually go out and, like, eat eggshells. You get trace amounts of calcium and build your teeth. But you can get trace amounts of jet fuel additive and build your body out of that. And that doesn't go away because it's, like, become a permanent part of your infrastructure, basically. So, you know, this is an argument in form and in favor of biomimetics and neobiology. Okay, we at least need to, like, understand the mimetic nature of our own body and try not to build technological artifacts that our body builds bodies out of. I mean, that stuff just needs to be, like, moved out of the production stream entirely so that we don't end up using our own unconscious processes that actually make ourselves into, what's the proper term for it? It isn't cyborgs, but just people carrying a heavy load. You know, and they're not all toxins.
I think
toxins.
We call it dumps, actually.
Dumps, yeah. We're dumps. We're turning our bodies into dumps.
Again, it's Cygraph. Sterling says, it's painful, but we need to understand that our bloodstreams are our dumping grounds. So are our lungs and livers. If we could visualize that, if we knew and could prove what had gone on wrong inside of ourselves, if we could put a digital medical imaging screen on our bellies, our lungs, and our livers, and make those invisible problems visible, then everything would become different. If that knowledge was attached to every object in our possession, the objects that are killing us would vanish quickly. He continues, "We cannot turn our entire planet's crust into obsolete objects. We need to locate valuable objects that are dead and fold them back into the product stream. In order to do this, we need to know where they are and what happened to them. We need to document the life cycles of objects. In practice, this is going to mean tagging and historicizing everything. It's possible to live in a cleaner way. We live in debris and detritus because of our ignorance. That ignorance is no longer technically necessary. Those who know, know. Instead, our problem is becoming obscurantism, which is deliberate hiding of the facts by vested interests who know they are injuring us. Such acts of evil must be combated. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. End quote.
Entropy in the industrial process, because that's what the greenhouse effect is. I mean, basically, it's a smokestack, it's a tailpipe, and we put the trash into the sky, and now the weather's wrecked.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land.
Apparently, the whole planet is in danger from man-made global warming.
The senior threat for Stirling and for all of us is rapid destabilization of the planet due to man-made greenhouse gases.
You know, I mean, fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it pretty much all the time. I don't think people are ever going to realize how much change is necessary because people don't realize how much change has already occurred. I don't think that's really the point of doing it. I mean, it's not trying to enlighten the entire masses to do it. I mean, when people adjust, it's basically something like people fleeing the Ninth Ward and running far away, but they don't really have very far to go. I mean, the adjustments don't come because you realize one morning that climate change is happening. The adjustments come because you get an insurance bill for your home in Key West, and it suddenly costs more than the mortgage because insurers just don't want to go to Florida. Because Florida was scourged by four hurricanes in a row, and they can't go anywhere. So certain areas become uninsurable, and then you find buildings being abandoned, and, I mean, that's just the way that climate change works. I mean, you read Jared Diamond, and you can see that there have been periods of climatic stress in other societies, and if there's no water, people go, and, you know, if there's less topsoil, the population dwindles. We're not going to be able to design that out. I mean, the ideal tech solution, should there be one? I mean, there are two. First would be emission-free energy. That's a pipe dream, but, you know, you never know. Pipes have been known to blow up, you know, every once in a while. Something weird happens. And the other would be not adaptation, but just sucking the effluent out of the atmosphere. I mean, literally, the carbon dioxide that's there and the methane needs to be sucked out and somehow put back in the ground. It should not have been up there in the first place. And, you know, to go out and tell people, well, put more tarpaulins on your roof, that's not really going to help. We're in a condition of climate change right now. I would predict that it will go through numerous phases. In other words, we don't simply have the nice climate and then the new climate, which is not so nice. We'll have a degraded climate, a seriously degraded climate, a freakishly degraded climate, you know, utter mayhem. And at that point, emissions stop because most of us are dead. So, you know, we actually need to redress, sort of take vigorous steps to do something or other. But, you know, it's not something your aunt at Bethnal Green is going to do. She's not going to go out with a soda straw and suck carbon dioxide out of the sky. This is going to have to be done by people who have some vague idea what they're doing, and they have to have, you know, effective techniques and some backing and some legal coverage and this, that, and the other. You know, where that comes from, I don't know, but the pressure is just going to get worse and worse. And, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to be doing that myself. What I'm going to be doing is making it thinkable, making it imaginable. I mean, everybody talks about mitigating carbon. Very few people talk about vigorously removing carbon. I can promise you they will be talking about that a whole lot in 10 years, all the time, all the time. And, you know, I'm one of the first people to sort of say it in public. I'm saying it to a very small public. That does not matter. Time is on my side. I was talking about climate. I wrote a novel about climate change in the early 90s. You know, you just watch the calendar.
Climate change appeared in the background of several of Stirling's science fiction books, including Islands in the Net and Involution Ocean. But the burning post-carbon world stars in his 1994 book, Heavy Weather, which continues to sell well. At the turn of the new century, Stirling came out with the Viridian Manifesto and his personal eco-discussion list focusing on green design. The website says the design philosophy is to create irresistible demand for a global atmosphere upgrade. As a cyber activist, Bruce Stirling is pasted all over the net. In addition to his own discussion list, his science fiction fans and the futurists and designers, they all have Stirling discussion groups. He's also involved with a number of the most popular green blogs, including his co-conspirator Alex Steffen at worldchanging.com.
It's time we accept bad weather as a vital natural resource, one we as a nation should be proud of.
At times, Stirling isn't sure he wants George Bush to act on global warming because Bush poisons everything he touches. Just imagine the new security state with nuclear prisons Bush would demand to fight climate change. We need to act at every other level instead. Back in 1999, before Al Gore made a movie, speaking before a convention of industrial designers, Stirling recalls the 600 people in that city who died of heat in July 1995. He reminds his tech-savvy audiences all their cool gear is still powered by carbon-belching coal. When it comes to heat, they ain't seen nothing yet. He tells them, quote, "People have tremendous powers of denial. We're living in that denial right now. As a society, as a civilization, it's all about puff, 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 beep, beep, honk, honk, and never mind the consequences." End quote. Then, he says, by 2005, civil liberties will be lost in a form of neo-Stalinism. Ha! Obviously, that could never happen in America. One of his later novels, Distraction, weaves in the themes of the Viridian movement. Again set in post-global warming America, the main character, there are no heroes in a Stirling novel, worries his way through new strategies and models of power in the chaos of climate-wracked culture. And yet, despite writing about a wrecked ecosphere, Stirling says, quote, "I'm an optimist, and I'm the hard kind of optimist because I'm a post-pessimist. I think the greenhouse effect is the central problem of our civilization right now. We don't face the problem, but we sure as hell have it. It's not that big a problem. Not compared to the nuclear arms race, or the military-industrial complex, or the population explosion, or fascism, or communism, or the other 20th century crises that we don't fuss much about anymore, because they're old hat. The greenhouse effect isn't a dramatic problem, like playing Russian roulette with hydrogen bombs. The greenhouse effect is a chronic problem, like cigarettes." End quote.
You know, I mean, fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it. Pretty much all the time.
He still thinks that intelligent humans can somehow use 21st century technology to save the planet from the old machinery of Rockefeller Oil, Edison Power, and Ford cars. In an article written for the Sierra Club, Stirling describes this way out. The first and most sensible technology is one that does its work and then eventually rots and goes away by itself. Its core materials and processes are biodegradable, so it's self-recycling. Writer Janine Benyus talks about biomimetic technologies. Architect William McDonough describes cradle-to-cradle production systems. This means harnessing the same biochemical means of production that built the natural world, and using them to create industries, cities, products, everything. It means room-temperature industrial assembly without toxics. No foundries, no pesticides, no mercury. When an object made by these processes is abandoned or worn out, it becomes part of the biosphere. End quote. All of this is to be supplemented with the new cybernetic products, the SPIMES, which are mostly data with very little mass required. After all, we already buy the idea of the product as much as the thing itself. His hope. If we handle the huge transition correctly, it will be worth cheering. In 50 years, nature will be less oppressed. Culture will be wiser. Government will take new and improved forms. Industrial systems will be more efficient and capable, and business will be less like a rigged casino. Purveyors of art, fashion, and design will see what went on nowadays and bust a gut laughing in derision. Our children and grandchildren will get up in the morning, look at the news, and instead of flinching in terror, they will see the edifying spectacle of the world's brightest people transparently solving the world's worst problems. This sounds utopian, but it could soon be everyday life. Bruce Stirling audio clips came from his excellent speech at SWX 2005, available on the net, and from a new interview on BigPicture.tv. This report is from Radio Eco Shock. available free at www.ecoshock.org.
And we're not going to be able to like double talk our way out of that. We're actually going to have to create a society that no longer depends on that resource or the way in which it's dug up, mined, and distributed. And there's only so much of it, and burning it is visibly bad for us. So we just got to invent our way around it. We got to out-create it.